The DeBroy-Boehm interpretation. So we'll have a bit more time for your questions. We'll be talking about criticisms of the interpretation. So stop me at any point if you just want to ask questions or have a thought about what the interpretation's about. So let me just remind you from last time how the interpretation works. Okay, so this was the example of DeBroy-Boehm for two particles. The complete description of reality was given by the wave function on the configuration space. It was necessary to specify, in addition to the wave function, the positions of each particle. So that's the supplementary information that DeBroy-Boehm adds to the description of reality. And then the evolution was just Schrodinger equation for the wave function and guidance equations for the particles, where the guidance equation is basically take the phase of the wave function, S, that's defined down here, take its gradient with respect to R1, for example, divide by the mass of particle 1, evaluate at the positions of the two Bowman particles, and that gives you the velocity for particle 1. So it's a first-order theory. The point in configuration space completely specifies the velocities of all the particles. I should say the point in configuration space together with the wave function. Once you have those two things, the dynamics is fixed. We also saw how there's a distinction between occupied and empty waves. So if I have a decomposition of psi and the position of the Bohmian particle is inside the spatial support of one of these wave functions, so the points in configuration space that are assigned non-zero amplitude by that wave function, then we say that wave's occupied. Otherwise, we say it's empty. And if only one of the waves is occupied, then it means that the guidance equation depends only on that wave. The velocity of the particle will depend only on the phase of that particular component. So basically, all the empty waves become ineffective at guiding the particle. They're irrelevant. Yes?
In your equation, if you have two particles, you have an interaction potential between both of them in Schrodinger equation?
Yes.
It's like it's completely independent of the position of the particles.
That's right. Yes.
Is that a bit strange?
Because
the wave function is a life of two interacting particles that exists like with no connection if the particles are actually there or not.
That's right. The wave function doesn't care about the particles. The proponent of the DeBroy-Boehm interpretation would say, you know, we need the particles there to be able to have definite outcomes of experiments, for example. So, you know, when in the usual textbook approach, when you look at Schrodinger's cat, you have to admit, well, you know, it seems like there's a funny quantum state. It's hard to interpret. The Bohmian could say, oh, but the particle positions pick out one of the branches and specify that the cat is either alive or dead. So there was nothing wrong with the dynamics of the wave function, but we needed some extra variables to make certain outcomes definite, and that's what the particle positions are doing. So when I have two particles that have an interaction Hamiltonian, the Bohmian positions, you know, will respond, but the way it happens is that the wave function starts evolving differently by virtue of that coupling term in the Hamiltonian. And then the change in the wave function induces a change to the quantum potential that the particles see. Or equivalently, the guidance equation will, you know, depend on the wave function, and therefore the way the particles move will depend on the fact that there is that interaction term in the Hamiltonian. Other questions about Bohmian mechanics? Yes?
The empty waves, if they don't affect the guidance equation, then how are they useful?
How are they useful? Well, sometimes, like if I have an interferometer, right, I have a beam splitter, the wave function, now there's a component corresponding to propagating on the left and a component propagating on the right. So I have a coherent superposition of wave packets on both arms of the interferometer. Now the Bohmian position just takes one of those. So while you're in the arms of the interferometer, one of those wave packets is empty. But in this case, in the future, those two wave packets interfere again, and now the empty wave influences the dynamics. So if we try to collapse the wave function, right, just eliminate those waves and take our new wave packet that's just on one side of the interferometer and evolve it forward in the Schrodinger equation, we would get different predictions because it would get to the next beam splitter and split up, and it wouldn't re-interfere with its partner. So sometimes empty waves become effective in the future when they re-interfere with the occupied wave. But what I'm going to show today is that if you have a lot of decoherence, so if your system's interacting with many degrees of freedom in the environment, then it becomes incredibly difficult to see any re-interference. And so effectively all those empty waves never re-interfere if you have enough decoherence. So there's a sense in which, you know, unless somebody devoted huge amounts of resources to try to recollect all the environment and evolve it backwards to a situation where it no longer contains information about, say, which way a particle went in an interferometer, unless you did all that, then those empty waves will never be significant for the dynamics of the particle again. So I'm not sure I answered your question. It seemed to me in the beginning you were saying, well, you know, why should we have them?
Yeah.
Did I answer your question?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. So the Bohmians say, well, we have to have them because, you know, sometimes they re-interfere. And in those cases, you know, we want to be in accord with the quantum predictions. So it's different from a collapse theory, where they would say sometimes the wave function just changes. And the predictions are different from quantum mechanics. Here, the predictions will always be in accordance with quantum mechanics, if you have the standard distribution. So if you choose these non-equilibrium distributions, like we saw at the very end of last lecture, then you could have predictions that are different, but not because the wave function is evolving any differently. Beth, did you have a question?
Or?
No. Good. So we saw what those dynamics look like for some simple single particle examples, like double slit. Something I didn't mention last time, but which is kind of interesting, what about the following problem? So the velocity of the particle depends on the phase of the wave function. But if the amplitude of the wave function goes to zero, then the phase becomes undefined. So is this a problem? Is it going to be the case that a particle which comes to a node is not going to know how to behave because the phase is undefined?
Can a particle ever get to the actual node?
No, it can't. Does anybody know why it can't get to the nodes? Well, the nodes are features of the wave function, and the particle positions are distinct from the wave function. So the question is, why can't the particles move into some region of space where the wave function has value zero? Maita?
I actually have a question.
Oh, sure. Well, if I continued putting more and more finely spaced positions here, so I started filling this in, I would get trajectories between all of these trajectories. And I would even see trajectories getting, you know, closer and closer to this point here that's between these peaks. But no matter what spacing I chose here, there would be one point where, strictly speaking, no trajectories would ever arise. So that's just, you know, the one point corresponding to the node of the wave function. But the question is why? You know, what is it about the theory that prevents the particles from ever reaching there? Or, like, you know, maybe it doesn't happen in double slit, but it'll happen somewhere else. So I've already told you something about the theory that implies that these particles can never get to the nodes.
Well, there's no trajectory that's
there. True. Okay.
If you follow these directions, you'll never get to these points.
All right. Tuber?
Is it related to the fact that somehow those are the maxima and the minima? So the derivative of S, is that somehow related to
that? I'm not sure. There may be many answers to this question. The reason I was thinking of is that we proved last time that if I start in the standard distribution, meaning that the ensemble of possible particle positions is distributed according to psi squared, then for all future times it's distributed according to psi squared. So if the probability of finding a particle at a node was zero initially, and that's what the assumption of the standard distribution says, then the probability of finding it at a node at any future time is going to be zero. And that's why you never have to worry about the guidance equation becoming not well defined. Of course, if you're doing a non-standard distribution, then this could potentially be a problem. I suspect that people have looked at that, people who, like Valentini, who promote non-standard distributions, probably have an answer to that question, but I don't know offhand what it is. Okay. So let me remind you of a couple of other things before showing you how de Broglie-Bohm reproduces all the predictions of operational quantum mechanics. So we went over this slide last time. If I have a quantum state of two particles that's in a product state, then the phase, total phase, is just a sum of the two terms, and the guidance equation for each individual particle is given just by the phase of the wave function for that particle. So in product states, the two particles evolve essentially independently. Which means that if the total state's an entangled state and only one of those terms is occupied, then the occupied wave is a product and the two particles are doing their own thing. Okay, so how does all this allow us to reproduce the operational predictions? So I'm going to consider the simple case where you're doing just a projective measurement, and we're essentially going to do a model of the measurement apparatus. So remember, this is a realist interpretation. So proponents of the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation essentially want to eliminate terms like measurement and observers from the postulates and talk entirely in terms of particles and their positions and what they're doing. And so I'll give you a quantum model of the measurement and then see what Bohmian mechanics predicts. So if phi k's are the eigenstates of this Hermitian operator A, and chi is so I'm imagining R prime describes the position of some probe. So basically the measurement is going to be a coupling between the system interested in and some probe particle. And for example, in von Neumann's textbook, he imagines that the probe particle is deflected by an amount corresponding to the eigenvalue of the Hermitian operator A. But there's many other models. All that's really important is that the final quantum state of the probe particle, if the initial state of the system was in the eigenstate phi k, should be chi k, where the chi k's are now orthogonal states. And in Bohmian mechanics, it's particularly good if they're spatially disjoint states, because that's important in Bohmian mechanics. So let's remember that the chi k's are the different states for the probe particle. And now if I prepare a coherent superposition of the eigenstates of A for my system, then the whole thing evolves by linearity to some entangled state between the system and the probe. So this is just like what we had in the lecture on the measurement problem. You know, this was the system and the apparatus entangled. Okay, so now how is the Bohmian going to interpret this? Well, if it's the case that these different states of the probe, quantum states of the probe particle, are indeed disjoint in space, okay, let's assume that, then we can ask the following question. What's the probability density of the particle of the system being zeta and the probe being zeta prime? The probability density of that configuration of the Bohmian particles being in the support of the jth wave in this quantum state here. So that's just going to be the absolute value squared of the jth wave evaluated at zeta and zeta prime. Okay, so that's just the standard distribution assumption. I've put in zeta and zeta prime and asked for the probability density. And then if I ask what's the overall probability density for the Bohmian particle positions being anywhere in that jth wave, I just have to integrate over the zetas, and phi j and chi j are normalized wave functions. So the overall probability of being in the jth wave is just cj squared. Okay, so this is the probability, if you just now ask the probability, you know, what's the chance that these two Bohmian positions for the system and the apparatus are inside the support of the jth term? Answer, cj squared. Okay, so the Bohmian will say, first of all, that whenever the Bohmian particle positions are in that jth wave, well, that corresponds to, you know, the measurement, the probe finding outcome J, right? Because, you know, the probe is supposed to indicate something about the system, and we're saying that the chi jth state, you know, corresponds to the jth eigenvalue. So that it makes sense to say, well, that corresponds to the outcome J. And so we're getting that the probability of getting the outcome J is Cj squared, which is in accord with the operational theory. But more than that, if you ask what happens after the measurement, so the jth wave comes to be occupied, and all the other waves are empty now, because we're assuming that these guys are, the different terms here are disjoint in space. So after the measurement's done, the wave function that guides the system's position is now just phi j. So effectively what's happened is that you've gone from the initial situation where the wave function that guided the motion of the system was this superposition to a final situation wherein the wave function that guides the Bohmian position is just the jth term. And so that's like the collapse of the wave function that we see in operational quantum mechanics using the projection postulate. So Bohmian mechanics can make sense of that. It says it's not a real collapse, it's just an effective collapse. It says that the dynamics of your position only depend on this wave function now, so it's sufficient to use it for the purposes of calculating what's going to happen next. Yes? Could we get this result in normal quantum mechanics? Yes. Okay. Well, we don't have anything analogous to an actual particle position in textbook quantum. So here, we're, you know, what we can say about what we can ask is what's the wave function that's sufficient for guiding the particle. But in regular quantum mechanics, you know, we don't have any term of the wave function that's picked out as special, so we can't really talk about what wave function is sufficient for, you know, picking out what actually happens, because there's no extra information that picks out a term of the wave function. Now, there is something called modal interpretations of quantum mechanics, which are in the same spirit as de Broglie-Bohm, but effectively they say there's a preferred basis for the wave function, and one of those terms corresponds to reality. And the overall wave function is like a pilot wave. It just sort of says, is reality this term or that term? But unlike de Broglie-Bohm interpretation, the preferred basis is not always position. The preferred basis depends on the quantum state. And if there's time, I could talk a bit about that. It might be what you sort of have in mind, that, you know, maybe we could have another way of picking out one of these terms that doesn't rely on postulating a position. Other questions about that?
It's kind of unrelated. What's actually waving? Is it still like there's a quantum field for each particle, and each particle rides along on its associated, like, what's our quantum field? Or what's happening? Like from the QFT.
What's happening in quantum field theory?
Yes.
I'll get to that before the end of the lecture. Talk just a bit about what, you know, doing a Bohmian interpretation of field theories. Bosons and fermions are modeled differently in those sorts of problems. But your question was, what's waving? I assume you meant the wave function.
Yes.
Let me just say a bit about that. So de Broglie, when he first wrote down the theory, actually postulated waves in free space, one for every particle position, one for every particle. And so you'd hope that, you know, every particle is guided by its own wave. And then he wrote down equations that were coupling. He called these the U waves, I think. And he wrote down equations that coupled these U waves together. And he was trying to reproduce the predictions of quantum mechanics. And eventually, he thought he'd proven that the theory he had in mind was equivalent to this theory I've described, where you could just say, oh, let's imagine that the particles are pushed around by this wave that lives in configuration space. Right? It's now a multidimensional configuration space, and there's a single wave. And he said, so we may as well, for convenience, use this formulation of the theory, because it's easier to do calculations. The other theory he had these very ugly differential equations that were coupled and difficult to solve. So I said, well, let's just use this because it's easier. But his proof of the equivalence, he assumed that the quantum state was a product state. He didn't allow for the possibility that it was entangled. And precisely when it's entangled, this connection breaks down. Because if every particle just had its own three-space wave that was guiding it, then there'd be no way to explain things like Bell inequality violations. It would be a local theory. So as I read the history, so Antony Valentini and Guido Bacigalupi have written a book on the history of de Broglie-Bohm, and actually it's about the 1927 Solvay conference. And the way I read it, de Broglie was actually mistaken about his own theory. He thought it was local. He constructed it to be local. He thought it was equivalent to this theory. He was wrong. It's not. This theory is non-local. Around the same time that de Broglie was writing down this theory, Einstein was working on similar theories, pilot wave theories. And Einstein realized at a certain point that his theory was non-local. And so Einstein actually pulled out from presenting at the 1927 Solvay conference because he didn't like his theory anymore because of the non-locality. And it's interesting. I wonder, you know, it's sort of maybe a useful mistake, because if de Broglie had realized, so my assumption is that de Broglie didn't realize this mistake. Had he realized it, maybe he wouldn't have proposed the theory. Probably Bohm would have rediscovered it in the 50s anyhow. But yeah, it's just an interesting fact about the history. Okay. So one thing you might worry about here is we have this effective collapse, but we know that empty waves in the future can always, you know, re-interfere. And you might say, well, is it really a collapse? Because, you know, in operational quantum mechanics, we never see those other terms of the wave function being important any longer. Whereas here, it's conceivable that those other terms could come back to haunt us and influence the dynamics. So why is it that this is a good approximation? And the answer there has to do with decoherence. So I'm not going to say anything about a particular model of decoherence. So decoherence is the name given to the phenomena that if you have, you know, a set of quantum states that cause the environment to go into different quantum states, the environment can carry away information about that basis, then even though nobody's looking at the environment, so this environment's not being used to measure the system, the environment is reducing the coherence between the states in that basis. And there's lots of studies of particular detailed models of environments and how they're interacting with systems and rates of decoherence and all that. You'll do that in the last homework assignment. You'll look at a particularly simple model of decoherence. It's important for all these interpretations. Here, I'm just going to use its most basic properties. So let's look at what the effect of decoherence is. I have my system, my probe, and now I'm going to imagine a whole bunch of degrees of freedom, which are environmental degrees of freedom. So, you know, sometimes you can think of this as, you know, air molecules in the room or cosmic rays interacting with your system, stuff that's coming in from the outside. But it's also appropriate to imagine that if I'm talking about, for example, the center of mass of some complex system, then the internal degrees of freedom of that system can also couple to the center of mass. And those internal degrees of freedom can be the environment that carries away information about the center of mass degrees of freedom. So it's not necessarily a completely distinct system. It could be other degrees of freedom of the system you're interested in. The key is that the interaction should be such that, given the initial state of the environmental degrees of freedom, there should be a subscript k here, the environment goes into one of a set of orthogonal states depending on what the state of the system is. So here, you know, if the probe, for example, is interacting with the environment, then depending on which quantum state the probe is in, the environment will go into different states. And if the environment's very large, then it goes into approximately orthogonal states extremely quickly. So decoherence typically happens on a time scale that's much, much shorter than energy relaxation, for example, much, much shorter than almost any other time scale in the problem. So as soon as you get large systems, it becomes very hard to isolate them from the environment, very hard to avoid decoherence. Yes?
Can we think of something that decoherence as a system that is not informationally isolated?
Yes, that's right. Exactly. Okay, so let's consider the same situation. I have a superposition of the eigenstates of the observable A for the system. I have my probe ready to measure. I have my environment in its initial state. At the end of the day, the probe has measured the system, and the environment has carried away information about which state the probe has gone into. So now, if it's the case that the wave functions of the environment for different labels are spatially disjoint, and again, if the environment is very large, then that's almost inevitably going to happen. You know, so if you think about you know, a pointer, and then you just have light bouncing off of it and air molecules bouncing off of it, well, clearly those degrees of freedom are going to keep track of whether it was pointing here or here. So the final configuration of the environment is going to be extremely different spatially depending on whether the pointer was here or here. So this is, you know, even if you said that these chi k's aren't disjoint in space, it's very likely that the states of the environment will be disjoint. And so if the jth wave is occupied, so that I get this kind of effective collapse for the dynamics, the only way that I could hope to reinterfere with the empty waves is if all of these eta k wave functions get mapped back to eta. Then I could start to, and the chi k's get mapped back to one particular chi, then I could start to see this interference again. And maybe it's conceivable that for a single probe particle, you could sort of undo the dynamics. But if you've got, you know, 10 to the 23 particles that have carried away information, and you'd have to gather all those and undo their dynamics, that becomes effectively impossible. And so, in effect, this effective collapse is irreversible. Just in practice, there's no way that you could get back to a situation where you see interference. So that's how the Bohmian responds to the challenge of, you know, what about these empty waves re-interfering with the system? You can say if decoherence has happened, then it's effectively irreversible. Good? All right. So I'll make a couple of other comments about the theory, and then we'll get on to the objections, unless there's more questions. No? All right. Oh, there was a question. Sorry.
Why is it impossible to map the states of the environment back to the original, the eta case?
It's not impossible. It's just incredibly hard. So what would be a simple example? Like, so for example, let's say I shine some light, I'm outside, and I shine some light to determine whether the particle's here or here. So that light scatters off the particle, and it gets sent off into space. Okay, so the light now, you know, it's focal, it originated either here or here, so it has a different spatial distribution. So if I want to, you know, re-interfere those two particle positions, I'd have to go reflect that light. So actually, in that case, there's an argument to be made that unless the reflectors are already set up, I can't catch up with the light. How am I ever going to turn it around and bring it back and eliminate that interference? Or, you know, in a more practical example, if I have a box of gas and you know, on this side I have vacuum and I have a particle in a superposition of being in two places, and I open the piston, and now the gas interacts with the particle. Let's say it's a very massive particle, so it doesn't change its location much, but it measures, the gas now has information about which side the particle is in. To undo that interaction, you know, I would need to do a unitary, which is the equivalent of reversing the direction of motion of every one of those particles, setting it backwards in time, bouncing off all the walls, undoing itself so that this is back. It's just inconceivable. An entropy thing.
Okay.
I suspect that you could think of it in the thermodynamic sense. I'm not sure exactly what I would say. I mean, if it's generally the case that if I have a box of gas here, 10 to the 23 particles, I don't assign a pure state to them. You know, I'm not in a situation of knowing precisely what the quantum state of those 10 to the 23 particles is. If I did know it precisely, then you could say, oh, well, I just have some overall pure quantum state. The unitary is whatever the coupling is. Maybe I could engineer a unitary that would just do the time reverse of that. Given my knowledge of the quantum state. But basically, we never have that much knowledge. You know, usually we say, oh, that gas, that's in a Gibbs state. It's a highly mixed state. And so we don't even have the information we need to properly reverse the dynamics. Yes, Joel.
This idea of your coherence seems to be exactly the same thing as in regular quantum mechanics.
Yes.
This is not weaker or stronger way of seeing the collapse thing.
That's true. You're absolutely right that in regular quantum mechanics, operational quantum mechanics, we could ask the question, why don't we see interference for macroscopic objects? Now, there are two kinds of answers to that question. One is, if I have a very heavy object and I try to put it through a double slit, then the size of the fringes is inversely proportional to the mass of the object. So typically, we don't have the resolution to see interference for heavy objects. But secondly, the reason we often don't see quantum effects is because the coherence is destroyed by interaction with the environment. So both those are reasons for the emergence of classicality. And you're absolutely right. I could have presented this early in the course. It has nothing to do with Bohmian mechanics. But the Bohmians definitely need that to explain how effective collapses occur.
So the thing is, if this is sufficient to explain the effective collapse in Bohmian mechanics, it's also good to explain it to normal quantum mechanics.
Well, not quite, because, it depends. It depends. If you're saying, what do we need an explanation of? Suppose you wanted to know, in operational quantum mechanics, why is it hard to build a preparation procedure wherein I can see the quantum nature of, baseball or something like that? Say that's the question you want the answer to. Then this story is adequate. But if instead you say, I think the textbook interpretation of quantum mechanics is fine, and I want to appeal to this argument to solve the measurement problem, and I would say that doesn't fly. Because although you can show that your two branches of the wave function become entangled with different degrees of freedom in the environment, the problem is always, how do I interpret that? I can't interpret it as one or the other being the case. I need to solve that either by saying that the wave function is not a complete description of reality, or saying that the wave function collapses to one of those terms, and then that's how I get definite properties. Would you agree? Yes?
How do we assume the first time that if I get an initial state of the probe and the environment evolves so that we still have 5k
You're right. This is a particular kind of measurement wherein the quantum state of the system is undisturbed if it's an eigenstate of the observable you're measuring. But I could imagine, that's just an idealization. I could say, well, a real experiment doesn't do that. It leaves the quantum state, it does a unitary on it, for example, that depends on which outcome occurred. So that's a freedom that we have in operational quantum mechanics as well. It was one of the things we didn't have time to really talk about in the first week, but I sort of flashed up a sort of more general form of what the collapse, the update rule for quantum states ought to look like. And there was this huge freedom. I said any trace non-increasing completely positive map could describe the nature of the update rule. It doesn't have to be project onto the outcome you got. And so similarly here, I could have something much more general. And for such cases, you wouldn't necessarily get phi j's as your final state. So let's say we have a unitary that acts on this depending on the outcome k. Well, I'll get that unitary acting on phi j as my effective final state, because all the other terms in this superposition are spatially disjoint, and only one of those is going to be an occupied wave. So, yeah, I haven't bothered to really give the full generality of how you reproduce operational quantum mechanics, but you can do it. Right. Okay, so just a few comments. You can ask, because there are now properties that the particles have. So the particles have the attribute of position. Attribute is just another word for property. So is it the case that when we do a measurement of the position operator, that we're actually just revealing the Bohmian position? Well, one thing you can ask is it the case that the quantum probabilities for different, the quantum expectation values for various functions of the position operator are given by the same function of the Bohmian positions, but now the classical expectation value with respect to the Bohmian distribution? It turns out that that is true. So we say that position measurements are statistically faithful. But it's not true for momentum measurements. So the first order term, the first moment of momentum, is reproduced by the Bohmian momenta, right? So this is the mass and the velocity of the Bohmian particle. This is the distribution. So I can get this back, but I can't get something like the second order moment. So I haven't worked it out here. But if you calculate the Bohmian velocity squared times the mass, so this is actually the kinetic energy of the Bohmian particle, and say what's its expectation value with respect to this distribution, it's not the same as the quantum expectation value. So you can write down an expression for the quantum expectation value. It's more complicated than this. It involves things like the quantum potential. So effectively, a measurement of kinetic energy is not just a measurement of the properties of the Bohmian particles, it's also a measurement of some properties of the quantum state. And so there isn't this simple translation between Hermitian operators and properties of the Bohmian particles. So I've just said that the measurement statistics for most measurements depend not just on the configuration of the Bohmian particle, but also on the wave function. And there's similar comments to be made about conservation laws and symmetries. So if I look at the Bohmian particle's energy, there's a sort of natural definition for the Bohmian particle's energy. Here's a kinetic term for its velocity. Here's the potential it sees. Here's the quantum potential. Given that the imaginary part of the Schrodinger equation looks like this, this is also just the partial derivative with respect to time of the phase of the wave function. And if you think about the form of an energy eigenstate, e to the I energy time, it's natural that this would be a Bohmian energy. So if you look at this quantity, you find that it's not conserved over time. But that's OK, because if you look at its expectation value, so its average, on average, it is conserved. And on average, it corresponds to the quantum expectation value. So basically, you're reproducing everything you know about quantum mechanics. The expectation value of the quantum Hamiltonian is conserved. But it doesn't necessarily map on to properties of the Bohmian particles being conserved, like this energy quantity. So in Bohmian mechanics, you have to be very careful to distinguish the quantum observables from the associated properties of the Bohmian particles. And proponents of the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation will say, this is part of the Bohr's lesson to us, that you have to take the whole experimental arrangement into account. So if I'm measuring energy, it's measuring something about the Bohmian particles, but also something about the whole wave function. And the whole wave function, to specify that, I have to specify exactly what the apparatus is doing. So typically in measurement theory and Bohmian mechanics, the wave function of the apparatus is important. So it's not as simple as you might have hoped that it would be. OK, last time we talked about the non-locality that you see in the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation. There's also contextuality. There's a lot of contextuality. So let me give you a very simple example of contextuality. It's also one of those things that's very weird and not as simple as you might have liked. So here, what I have is a particle that's confined to one of two rails. So really, it's a two-dimensional Hilbert space, because I'm telling you that, you know, it's a wave packet here or it's a wave packet there. And I can have coherent superpositions of here and there. So it's just that two-dimensional degree of freedom I'm interested in. And each of these boxes is going to be a measurement on that two-dimensional Hilbert space. So the way this one works, and they look identical, but in the third dimension, these two paths don't cross. Okay, so they basically bend around one another in the third dimension. And then I just have detectors asking me, you know, whether the particle's on that branch or not. So this is just a very fancy way of, you know, I would get the same thing if I just put the detectors here and here. It's just measuring which rail the particle's on. And that guy over there is the same, except now the two trajectories are in a plane. So they don't pass one another in the third dimension. The two trajectories pass through one another. But because of the linearity of the Schrodinger equation, if I have a superposition of two wave packets, say I call them phi A and phi B, phi AR plus phi BR, if I have a superposition, then to know how this evolves, I just have to know how this evolves and how this evolves. And you know, it's free space. They're evolving through free space. So they're just essentially going to evolve maybe with a little bit of dispersion, but effectively along a rectilinear path. And it's going to be irrelevant to phi A that it's in a superposition with phi B. It'll just evolve in its regular way, and so will phi B. And so each of those wave packets is not even going to see the other one. They're going to pass straight through one another onto the detectors. And so this is an equally good way of measuring which rail the particle's on. So it also corresponds to the same measurement as if I just put the detectors right on the paths. So both these are measurements of you know, which rail the particle's on. If I define the two quantum states as, you know, A and B, then this as a projected valued measure is just, you know, project onto A, project onto B. Both of these boxes measure this. Okay? So for an operationalist, they're in the same equivalence class. If I put one of these two in a black box, you would not be able to tell which it was. But for a Bohmian, they're very different. And that's because, as we saw last time, Bohmian trajectories don't cross. So if these two paths are separated in the third dimension, then you know, these trajectories are just going to go straight to the detectors. Whereas if they don't, they aren't separated in the third dimension, then the trajectories would have to cross, and so they have to bounce off one another. So this is my artist's rendition of what that might look like. But it probably would be a bit different than that. So now, if you ask, well, what do you expect to see statistics-wise, right? You have a wave function that's in a superposition of coming in these two. So you expect 50-50 statistics. And sure enough, in both cases, half the trajectories come out on top and half come out on the bottom, so you see 50-50 statistics. So you're in agreement with the operational quantum mechanics. But if you now ask, when I get the top outcome, where was the Bohmian position initially to ensure that outcome? Well, for this measurement, it tells you the Bohmian position was over here. But for this measurement, it tells you the Bohmian position was up there. So when you conclude operationally, the quantum state, let's say I got this outcome, you say the quantum state, this corresponds to the outcome, say, which would it be? B, right? So this is the B state here, so I'm getting the top outcome. When I get the outcome associated with the B quantum state, in one scenario, it teaches me that the Bohmian particle was down here in the support of B. And in the other scenario, it teaches me that the Bohmian particle was over in the support of A. So the indicator, the response functions, you know, when the detector fires conditional on the state of the Bohmian particles is completely different. It's the opposite, right? This detector fires in the opposite ontic states compared to this one. This guy fires for all these ontic states. This guy fires for all these ontic states. So the indicator functions are totally different, even though the two measurements are operationally equivalent, and that's contextuality. Tibor, you have a question?
Degree of freedom.
Yeah.
So that we, one of the particles spin up, the other one spin down.
Yeah.
So that I mean, I'm sure we should be getting the same answer as usual quantum mechanics. So does that mean that for the Bohmian particles, if they're spinning near field, they can actually, the trajectories can cross?
Yes. So here I said, look, there's an extra degree of freedom, namely where you are in the third dimension. And if these two wave packets differ in that degree of freedom, where they are in the third dimension, then I don't have a problem with these crossing trajectories, right? So similarly, I could have said I have this superposition of wave packets, and now I have another degree of freedom, some internal degree of freedom, like spin, which distinguishes them. Then ultimately, they have to not cross in configuration space. So they could cross in physical space, even in 2D, if they were non-crossing in some other space, like an internal degree of freedom space. That being said, there are different ways of modeling spin in quantum mechanics, and not all ways of modeling spin will save you from this problem. We'll talk about that in a couple of slides. So some people thought this is just way too bizarre, and so they gave the name surrealistic trajectories to these, because you would have hoped that, you know, just such a simple measurement, which asks, you know, where... it's a measurement of position, effectively. You'd have hoped that it would reveal the Bohmian particle's position, and it doesn't. The Bohmians say, look, what this tells us is that you just can't associate an attribute, some property of the particle, with an operator without also telling me what the full experimental arrangement is. Even if for something like position in Bohmian mechanics, you need to specify exactly what's going on in the experiment to know what your Hermitian operator really corresponds to measuring in terms of the Bohmian particle positions. Okay. Even if you're happy with that response, let me just point out one other interesting fact, which is that the no-go theorems we saw on contextuality, like the Cauchy-Specker theorem and the other theorems I showed you, didn't work for this kind of difference, right? So this is... they both correspond to this measurement. You can't get a contradiction from assuming that two versions of this measurement are represented the same way. So in a sense, Bohmian mechanics posits contextuality where it didn't need to posit it to avoid a contradiction. In all those cases, the Cauchy-Specker type constructions, it'll show contextuality because it has to on pain of contradiction. Here, it didn't have to on pain of contradiction, but it does. So it has, in some sense, more contextuality than it really needed. It's the same with non-locality. Bohmian mechanics has, in a sense, more non-locality than it needed just to generate the degree of correlation we see in the Bell experiments. So some would say that's a criticism, that you know, a nicer theory would have only had as much contextuality or non-locality as it really needed. But it depends on your preference. Okay, what's the classical limit of Bohmian mechanics? Well, if all you're interested in operationalism, then as long as operationally quantum mechanics goes over to classical mechanics, then because Bohmian mechanics reproduces the predictions of operational quantum mechanics, it will reproduce the predictions of operational classical mechanics in the right regime. So it can cover operational classicality. But you might say you want something more. This is a realist interpretation. It's trying to tell you what's happening in the world. So shouldn't it be that the kinds of pictures it gives us of particles moving around should go over to the Newtonian picture in the right limit, in some limit? It doesn't exactly. So you might want Newtonian trajectories for macroscopic objects. But there are some problems. So for instance, Newtonian trajectories can clearly cross because it's a second order theory, whereas the Bohmian trajectories never cross. So if I really had a macroscopic system and its center of mass was isolated from all other degrees of freedom, and I'm trying to think, how could I set up such a scenario? I can't think offhand, but there are papers that have been written on, you know, setting up scenarios for macroscopic objects such that Newtonian dynamics would tell you it would move one way, but the non-crossing of Bohmian trajectories reveals that it moves in a very unexpected way. So you can say, well, all right, it hasn't succeeded. However, typically for macroscopic objects, there's lots of decoherence going on. And so the decoherence will eliminate the interference. Now the systems can cross in the system's configuration space, because it's non-crossing in the configuration space of the environment. So as long as you always have enough decoherence, and proponents of this approach would say, you know, whenever we're talking about the macroscopic world, we've got tons of decoherence, and so, you know, we never see any disagreements with the predictions of Newtonian mechanics. Ricardo.
Don't you just say that for macroscopic options, that there are the trajectories of the centers of mass can come so close that the two options actually collide?
Well, all these avoided crossings are descriptions of a single system, right? So it's really the, you know, if the system, like the trajectories I was showing here, I'm not imagining sending multiple particles into this device. It's always just one particle. So it's really that this particle is kind of it's responding to the shape of the wave function. So it's the wave functions that are crossing here. And then the Bohmian dynamics tells me that if a particle came in along this trajectory, then it would sort of bounce off of empty space. You know, there's no particle here that it encounters. It just decides to move left because it's guided by a wave function, and the wave function interferes in this region. So if I prepared a macroscopic object, like a baseball, in a coherent superposition of being here or here, then Bohmian mechanics would say it's going to move not along a Newtonian trajectory, but it's just going to sort of bounce off of empty space and start moving upwards because of its wave function. Of course, that's a highly non-classical wave function, so it'd be extremely that would be as hard as preparing a Schrodinger cat state. Make a baseball be in a coherent superposition of here or here. And so the proponent of this approach will say that just, you know, you'll never be able to avoid the decoherence. And that's why you can see the baseball just travel straight down from the top to the bottom. Yes, Jan.
Can you not just move on the compass backwards and then you would be able to tell which trajectory of your object?
So what was it, move with what backwards?
The coupler.
The coupler.
So that's by the amount of time that's
taken. I don't know what you mean by the coupler.
Oh, like the measurement device.
Oh, so you want to move the whole measurement device?
No, like while the measurement.
Oh, I see. So you're saying put one of these detectors closer to the input ports than the other.
Yes.
That's a good question. So let's see, what would happen? You would have your, what would regular quantum mechanics tell us? Well, the wave functions come in, they pass through one another, and then, you know, you either get a detection here or not, and then later you get a detection here or not. That's a good question. So, yeah, how does the Bohmian reproduce that prediction? I don't know. Must have to do with the interaction between the wave function of the particle and the wave function of the detector. I have to think about that. It's a nice puzzle. I'm sort of confident in the way it comes out, just because there are these very general arguments about Bohmian mechanics reproducing the predictions of operational quantum mechanics, which we saw earlier. And those are sort of abstract arguments that make me confident that there'll be some way that Bohmian mechanics will prevent itself from being distinguishable from regular quantum mechanics, assuming we have the standard distribution. And so it's going to come up, I'm confident that there'll be some reason why you won't be able to use your trick to tell the difference. But it'll be interesting to see how it does it. It always has some trick up its sleeve. So it could be non-locality, it could be something else. I'll give it some thought. So the question was, if you moved one of these detectors closer to the input ports, right? So let's say this detector was here and this one was further back. Then you'd have timing information. You'd say, okay, I saw a detection at a particular time, and that would seem to be able to distinguish these two scenarios. So yeah, I have to think about it. Good. So we were talking about the classical limit. What did I say? So yeah, I think I said everything here. Decoherence can solve that problem. We talked a bit last time about the failure of Lorentz invariants. So the interpretation itself posits an ontology which does not respect Lorentz invariants. There's a preferred rest frame. But if you, and furthermore, you can even come up with these interpretations for relativistic field theories. I'll say a bit about that in a moment. And those also fail to be Lorentz invariant. However, it's still the case that Lorentz invariance is an emergent symmetry. If you look at statistical consequences of the standard distribution, you get agreement with operational quantum mechanics, so all your statistics is Lorentz invariant. So the Lorentz invariance is basically hidden from you if you're in the standard distribution. So you can think of this as a kind of underdetermination. There's you know, many possible choices of rest frame, and it ultimately doesn't make a difference to the statistics that you see. But the assumption here is that there is one, and the dynamics depends on it. Okay, so the last couple of criticisms all have to do with this underdetermination. So let me say a bit more about it. So this is a term used by philosophers to mean if there are many possible choices of ontological structure, or if there are many possible theories for what's going on that all agree with the experimental evidence, then you have a situation of underdetermination. So philosophers often worry about whether, you know, there could be two competing theories that are both equally adequate for explaining the phenomena. Here it's slightly different. We have, you know, we have different versions of de Broglie-Bohm interpretation that both reproduce the same phenomena, but that are different in some way. So, for instance, the choice of the preferred rest frame. So I'll just give you a few more examples of that. So one is the underdetermination in what the preferred observable is, what this supplementary variable is. The case we saw, it was position was preferred. So we decompose the wave function, the position representation, and we assume that every particle had a well-defined position. These were the dynamics. But you could also do it for momentum. You could say, right, we write down the wave function, the momentum representation, and now we assume that every particle has a well-defined Bohmian momentum, which I'll call pi. And the wave function evolves according to the Schrodinger equation, and the change in the momentum of the particle is given by a guidance equation. You take the phase of the wave function in the momentum representation, you take its gradient with respect to momentum, you evaluate at the Bohmian momentum pi, and that gives you the rate of change of the momentum of the particle. So Epstein proposed this immediately after Bohm came out with his paper in 1952. It's effectively, you could imagine doing any canonical transformation, and you know, you might have thought that this would give an equally good theory. So Bohm's response to Epstein was, first of all, that if you have a potential that's a 1 over R potential, then you have mathematical problems with the momentum-based theory. It becomes very hard to solve for what would happen to the Bohmian momentum in a theory with this kind of potential. And another objection, another response that people make is that what was critical in Bohmian mechanics is that whenever we do a measurement, the different outcomes are somehow distinguished by the position of something. So like a pointer goes into one of two positions. When I do a spin measurement, you know, I deflect the particle one of two ways to figure out what its spin is. It seems like almost every measurement we do, we can think of some way in which something comes to be in one or another place. And even if your measurement's not like that, then your environment carries away information, and usually that information gets encoded in whether something is one place or another. But you might ask, is that true for momentum space as well? When we do measurements, do the final states really differ by being disjoint in momentum space?
Yes. You could make the argument that ultimately your measurement always happens in momentum space because light hits your eye and it hits you at a certain frequency or something. I mean, you can always go from one to the other, right?
You're saying that if I have particles, you know, moving off in different directions, then that corresponds to
different
momenta.
Energies, yeah.
Yeah, that's.
And that's how you observe it, in fact.
I think that's a good rebuttal. You might have to go. No, I like that. Yeah, I think that's a good point. I don't think this is a particularly strong response to the criticism. I don't think this is a particularly strong response to the criticism either. But yeah, that's a very good point. Another point you can make, sort of against Bohmian mechanics solving this problem, is that even if you could solve it for position momentum, when you get to something like the electromagnetic field, you have a similar ambiguity in whether your preferred variable is going to be the electric field or the magnetic field or some other linear superposition of those. And there it becomes even harder to argue that one of them is adequate and the other is not. They both seem to give you equally good theories, and so there seems to be no way of deciding based on the experimental evidence which of those two should be the correct theory. Yes?
So this criticism of underdetermination
really
hits every single hidden variable theory you could come up with, though, right? Because if you have hidden variables, by definition, they're underdetermined because you can't see them, so they could be a lot of different things.
Not necessarily. Think of Plato's cave. It could be that my theory is such that the actual shape of the object is unique given the shadows I've seen. So that would say, look, there's no, I have to assume that the possible shapes of objects are this, this, and that because of the shadow patterns I've seen. It would be true that if I tried to postulate color for those objects, then there would be total underdetermination because the statistics would be the same for the different colors. So this is basically saying there's aspects of the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation that are kind of like the colors of the objects in Plato's cave. And that seems like something we don't want because it's just a methodological principle that a lot of physicists hold on to, that you shouldn't postulate ontological differences that don't make any difference to the experimental evidence.
But all the hidden variable theories we've looked at kind of have that, right?
Okay, so in the theory of the restricted statistical theory of bits, what was the analog of this?
Well, that doesn't represent quantum.
That doesn't represent quantum mechanics. True. I see. So you're saying in all the hidden variable models of quantum mechanics, meaning, we've only seen one so far.
It seems like this should be, this is going to happen with any hidden variable theory that properly represents.
Well, how about the Cauchy-Specker model for a two-dimensional system? So, we talked briefly about that guy. It was an adequate model for pure states and projective measurements on a single qubit. And just to remind you, the idea was that if I have a quantum state up along the n-hat axis, then I represent that by a distribution on a sphere, which is sort of peaked at plus n and goes to zero at the equator. And if I do a measurement along, say, the m-hat axis, then that corresponds to asking whether the particle is in the top hemisphere or the bottom hemisphere relative to that axis. So I don't see any obvious underdetermination there. But perhaps you could argue that, I also showed you another option for how to measure, to model qubits, in terms of the Bell-Merman model, which had two spheres. So you could say there was underdetermination at the level of which of those two theories ought we to believe in. And at that stage, you'd probably want to say, well, maybe there's some principles we can apply for selecting which are the best invariable models. Okay, so another example of underdetermination for what these extra variables are, it is in the treatment of spin. So Tibra, you were asking about this before. So one approach, the one that Bohm introduced together with collaborators, is that you have a position for particles, and you also sort of think of them as little rigid objects that have an orientation. And it's the orientation of that object that corresponds to the spin degree of freedom. So you can show that you can reproduce operational quantum mechanics for particles with spin using this model. But Bell, John Bell, same guy as Bell's theorem, showed that you could do it in another way, a more minimalist approach, where the only thing you posit is that these particles have positions. There's no extra degree of freedom associated with spin. And you can nonetheless reproduce the experimental statistics for spin degrees of freedom. So the effect of spin is basically seen only in the dynamics of the particle positions, because the wave function now has a motional component and also a spin component, and the wave function could influence how the particle positions move. So let me show you briefly how that works. You postulate now a two-component wave function, so it has a spin and just a particle position. The evolution equation is now the Pauli equation, so I'm imagining the spin is evolving through some magnetic field. And now you can choose your guidance equation so that the velocity of the particle is given by this expression. So this J is an expression for a current in terms of the wave function. So both components of the wave function appear in this expression. There's the vector potential. And this R is just the sums of the psi squares for the two components. And this defines a velocity field. And it turns out if you say that the positions move according to that velocity field, then if you start in standard distribution, you can prove that you always remain in the standard distribution, and you can reproduce all the regular predictions. Yes? Is what Gaussian invariant?
Is the theory? That appears the vector potential.
That's a good question. I suspect not. I think this is the guidance equation is not Gaussian invariant. So it'd be another example like the Lorentz invariance of something which would hold at the statistical level, but not hold at the hidden variable level. Yeah.
I think it would be Gaussian invariant. Because look at the main equation. We have a covariant derivative squared.
Yes.
So I don't know. The J has got all this crap in the front, which probably will cancel.
Hey, I mean, I guess you'd have to work out, you know, what's the apply the Gaussian transformation to the wave functions,
right,
and do the term to get here cancel this guy, this term here. So I'm not sure, but it wouldn't be contrary to the spirit of Bowie mechanics if it failed to be Gaussian invariant, because a lot of the symmetries we see, these guys are saying don't hold at the deeper level, and so there's a preferred rest frame at the deeper level. And there are, you know, Galilean invariance doesn't hold for the non-relativistic theory.
I guess energy is not conserved. If one is not shocked at that, you know, then one should
be shocked. So in the Stern-Gerlach experiment, for example, Bell's model says that actually all that's relevant for determining whether you get the spin up or the spin down outcome, you know, remember that ultimately you measure position. So it says, look, the particle comes in, and if it's in the top, then it goes up because the trajectories don't cross, and if it's in the bottom, it goes down. And you can reproduce all the statistics for spin experiments just using particle position. Another example of that is in quantum electrodynamics. So there have been de Broglie-Bohm interpretations of field theories. Oh my God, I'm over time. Sorry. So you have a model for bosonic degrees of freedom in terms of underlying field ontology. So Bohm showed that you can have either the electric field or the magnetic field as your Bohmian ontology, and you can model the free electromagnetic field that way. You can also model fermions in one of two different ways, introduced by Bell and Samuel Collin. This is recent work. He was a postdoc here at PI. And it basically corresponds to, you know, your extra variable is the fermion number at a lattice point. So it's like a second quantized approach. And you can imagine these things couple, and you can reproduce the predictions of QED. But like the spin case, you can also have a more minimalist approach where it's just the electric or the magnetic field, which is the fundamental degree of freedom. And you basically infer the presence of your charges based on the behavior of the fields. And because of things like Gauss's law, to some extent, the fields already contain the information about the charges. And so in this model, it's just the fields. Okay, so let me end there. And next time I can take any more questions about this theory, maybe say a few more words about it, and then move on to collapse theories. That's what we're doing tomorrow.